Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. Dessa is a writer, a rapper, a friend, and now she's a memoirist. She came to the Fitz last month to talk about her new book, My Own Devices, True Stories from the Road on Music, Science, and Senseless Love. And we're broadcasting that Talking Volumes conversation for you here. When Dessa and I met on stage, she acknowledged that this felt a little scary and kind of weird to be there as an author and not a musician. Dessa tweeted, "There might be some squirmy moments during that Q&A." Mm-hmm. And I tweeted back, "There might." "There will." This is really great. Does this feel a little weird? Usually either you're the one asking the questions or you're the one performing. Has this felt strange?
This definitely feels like being in the back seat of your own car, or maybe in the trunk of your own car. Yeah. It's a little uncomfortable. Please blink.
Wait a minute. The trunk of your own car. It's like, I can't get out, I'm trapped. That's how this feels?
There's less control than she's accustomed to. Yeah.
One of the things that strikes me about memoir and personal essays is the decision about what isn't said is, I think, every bit as important, especially as a first-time memoirist, mm-hmm. as what you decide to put on the page. And I'd be interested in knowing how you calibrated what to tell and what you wouldn't tell.
I think on the first draft of the whole book, I was more interested in, like, I feel like I had to prove I could really write. So I was writing and trying to come up with, you know, awesome figurative language and clever turns of phrase. And I submitted that to my editor, Maya, at Dutton, and she was like, "You can really write. What are you doing?" You know, how did you feel during that moment? Or, like, what did you tell your mom? So as the drafts progressed, so did the level of intimacy, yeah, that I shared. I was so afraid of being maudlin that I think at first I was overcompensating, you know, really trying to keep a clinical distance from some of the most intimate moments of my life.
You have experience with this, though. I mean, you know, when you're writing lyrics or you're writing music, you are making decisions about what may be in the breath that you're not saying or what's being held back in the lyric. Does this feel that different?
Yes.
It does.
It does.
Why?
I think in the span of like a 3.5 minute pop song, let's say, or a rap song, you can create a really cool and compelling world without having to fill in the details necessarily. Figurative language works really well in choruses and in verses and in bridges. You know, you can, as long as it sounds good, you're coming from an honest place and it's well crafted, you don't actually have to be like, "It was midnight, I was at Walgreens." You don't have to share the details that are so humbling. You can kind of do it in these broader strokes, you know? It's like the photo without the filter, you know?
What I feel like you mastered, though, in this is something Roseanne Cash has talked about, which is the direct vision and the peripheral vision. And often the peripheral vision is more interesting than the direct. Coming at the idea or coming at the experience from the side than straight on. What?
Yeah, I mean, I think in beginning to write, I started with the premise that other than, like, my closest friends, like, your biggest moments and your biggest wins and your biggest, most disappointing failures are not actually that interesting to strangers. They're just not.
Why? Why do you think that is?
Because if I said, like, you know, Billy Joe and Kellyanne, they just got divorced. Your next question is, who's Billie Joe and Kellyanne? I don't care. You know, I don't know those people. People get divorced all the time. But in their lives, that's like, that's the big tragedy of this 10 years for them. You know, it's not until you've already become invested in someone that their trials, tribulations, or successes would be of any interest to you at all. Mm-hmm. So for me, it feels like to earn the attention and the investment of a reader or a listener, you've got to present yourself as either skilled enough as a craftsperson or relatable enough or likable enough for anyone to want to attend to the events of your personal experience.
I mean, you also have to decide what this meant, I guess, in the moment, and then that's the peripheral side of this, right? Coming back around to say, now how do I understand what this meant, and does it mean what I thought it meant, or now that I've got more experience, this is how I see that.
Mm-hmm. Or also, it's like, okay, here was my experience at Walgreens at midnight in some personal throes, in some big, deep, sad moment of my life. I think the question for me as a human being might be, what does this say about my life? But the more interesting question is, what does it say about to be alive? The only portal to human life that I have is my own experience. But I'm hoping to use that small data set to answer bigger questions. You know, I'd like to know, and I've always wanted to know, I think, what's it like to be a guy? What would it be like to be black? What would it like to be a black guy in India? I mean, the truth of the world is not this. This is a very strange human way that we're living right now in St. Paul. Living comfortably, most of us. We're in a beautiful theater. We're safe from the rain outside that the microphones may or may not be picking up. This is a weird way to live. We have it so good that it's alienating probably for the rest of the human community, you know? So when you talk about coming at it sideways, I think sometimes, even if I'm like talking about a breakup, I'm tempted to use a lens that feels a little more universal. Like, what does science say about this?
Sometimes that's a technique to be able to step back and not put what you felt down on the page.
Oh, sure. Yeah, like I'm distancing. Yeah, oh, definitely. Right. Guilty, yes. Yes, it is. Right. But also, I think, to me, in some way, because I feel like there's something on the other side of the seesaw, which is this intellectual stuff, right, talking about science and brain anatomy, I feel like that gives me license to go further into feelings without feeling as though perhaps I've crossed the threshold into sentimentalism, because I've got a rope tied around my waist. And on the other side of that rope, we are assured is still a thinking, intellectual person who's not going to just veer off into her feelings without a mindful understanding of the fact that, like, people are reading with her. And I'm totally... It's ellipsis. You're right. It's sort of a defense mechanism.
I have to say... So this might surprise you. For the science sake, and we'll explain a little bit more about this in a minute, I found the science, just from that standpoint, interesting. But that isn't when I felt like I knew you. Even though you were discovering things about yourself, I knew you in the mundane, in the midnight at Walgreens, in the moments where you were showing me the stuff that seems ordinary. Mm. And that those moments of self-discovery from that. You're smiling about this. Why?
Because I'm afraid.
Why? In this moment or just in general?
Because I feel like you're doing that thing when a shark moves really slowly before... Yeah.
Wait, I'm doing what thing?
I don't want to get hypnotized and not be ready to defend myself.
You're falling under my spell.
Yeah, I know.
Right. But what about that?
I'm still trying to think, okay, if you ask someone to listen to a song, it's 3.5 minutes. That's a much smaller ask than reading a whole book, just time-wise, you know? So for me, it was to try to figure out how much value can I pile in, whether that value is humor or a relatable experience, or sometimes, and I did occasionally kind of have to argue for this when talking to my editor. I think it's cool just to put fascinating pieces of information in a memoir or a fiction and have them be there because they're fascinating.
But like what?
Okay, so in one section, I'm talking to my brother, and he and I both just like factoids. And so things like, you know that little piece of plastic at the end of a shoelace? That's called an aglet. The hashtag is called an octothorpe. ZIP is actually an acronym, like zip code for zone improvement plan. Like, that's all tight. And so I want to write it in my book.
And that made it in the book. I like what you say about being an artist. You write, part of the challenge in becoming an artist is that you have to place your bets before you're fully dealt. That's so well said. You have to assess your talent, still half formed, and decide what you're willing to stake on it. And I guess I would add to that, tell me whether this is true, that you also have to have the fortitude in the face of self-doubt, external doubt, to say, I place that bet on my talent and I believe in it, and you're gonna have a hard time shaking me off of that. So I wanna know what that's like.
Well, depending on the nouns and the verbs you use, that either sounds like a brave, defiant stand, or it sounds like intolerable vanity. After you've made it and you get to sit on the Fitzgerald stage, it sounds brave. But when you're talking to your parents over Thanksgiving dinner and you're 27 years old and you never did go to grad school, you know, like don't really have a career plan other than trying to make this music thing work. They're not like, wow, God, that's brave. Yeah. I mean, I'm lucky to have parents who really support me now. I say that, like, as of tonight, starting right now. No.
Are they here?
They are.
Are they?
Oh, yes. Mom and Dad, keep your hands down.
Yeah.
I'm lucky to have parents who've supported me for a very long time. But yes, like, at some point, you know, people are more interested in talking about, like, do you know how compound interest works than saying, like, go out there and slay that show in Albuquerque tonight, you know? You think I'm dodging?
Yeah.
Why do you think I'm dodging?
I think you're kind of being glib. Because I don't think you should underestimate what it means to place the bet on your own talent and your own fortitude before you even know what you've got. But I know that that takes a kind of inner... So I think of it as an inner calmness.
But what if I'd been wrong? That's the deal.
Right?
You can't
That's
tell
the gamble.
If you're wrong. But think about right now. Like, there, you know, if I were still determined to get to the Olympics as a gymnast, and I know that that's a joke, but, like, pick something else. As a swimmer, they do that older. Like, and I just wasn't making the times, man. I'm not making the times to compete, and I'm not making the times to compete. At some point...
No, because that's objective. What the kind of talent we're talking about is subjective.
No, I got you. Okay, I disagree, because what's objective is how many people come to Albuquerque.
No.
Oh, yes, it is.
Whether somebody shows up to a show or buys a book is not, that's an outside external measure, but that's not a true measure.
That's my measure, and I'm not kidding. If people were legit, I mean, I say in part of that in the book, that if I thought I had a really big talent, and it just turns out that in my era and in my culture in which I live, no one had particular interest in that talent and what didn't want to listen to the songs or read the book at all, I wouldn't keep doing it. Not because I think, well, it turns out then that I don't have any talent, but because for me, art is communicative. If there's no one to commune with, no one to have feelings together with, then I'd want to try to find a different way to commune.
What usually doesn't happen is something black and white, like nobody shows or nobody reads the book. It's kind of what you've built for yourself. I get encouragement, I break out. I go back to the hard work, somebody shows. That's what I think. Where the true fortitude and the gamble is. That's where I say you turn back to your calmest inner self and say, I've got it. I can.
Yeah.
No?
I don't want to. What I'm not trying to do is evade and constantly self-deprecate for a laugh. I'm one of the most driven people I've ever met. So there's that. You or not? I mean, you'd call, but. So I am driven. I am talented, and when I discover that I don't have a talent that I very much would like to demonstrate, I try very hard to gain that talent. But there is a difference, I still think, between, like, there are objective measures here, because if I weren't able to make my living doing this, mm-hmm. I would be tempted to try to find something that I am passionate about that I can make my living on, because I like the idea of those two spheres of my life intersecting.
Mm-hmm.
I like the idea of finding purpose, if I can, in my vocation.
But what I hear you wrestling with at different points in these essays is this what it is?
Oh.
There will be, no?
I said, oh.
Are you? Is that not right?
Do you mean like, is this winning?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that's also true. So I concede there that maybe a lot of people in the arts, or maybe a lot of people just in any profession or in anything they care about, find that the objective measures of success never do quite satisfy. But to me, I think it feels like there is an appetite and a drive that is regenerative. So it's not like, did you have a great dinner? And you're like, yeah. I'm like, cool. Then we're done with dinners. Like, tomorrow you're going to want a dinner too. It's just, you're going to be hungry again. So for me, I think that the drive to do and achieve and strive and reach a new audience or a new, you know, creative project, there is a thrill there, and then that recedes, and then the appetite regenerates to try something new.
I mean, some of this is, I think, about artistic integrity. Like, am I going to play to the objective measures and reap whatever rewards come from that? Mm. Or am I going to do the thing that really feeds the thing?
Oh, I see.
In there. And I kind of see you wrestling with some of that.
I see. I think that the bind that I'm in, or maybe the bind that I've put myself in,
yeah.
is that I want all those normal objective measures. I just don't want to compromise on anything ever.
Here we
them.
Are. This is it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the battle. Right?
Yeah.
Everybody feels that, I think, in whatever.
I just feel like it's not about me. It's about the way that audiences are praised.
Why can't it be about you?
Because I just don't think, I think that audiences are game to listen to a pop song, even if it has literary lyrics, as long as they're not distracting. I mean, I don't buy it. I don't buy this idea that you have to walk the well-worn line in an effort to reach commercial success. I don't actually believe it, because I don't think audiences are so stupid that they can't understand some subtext. I don't. I think the most interesting art for me is sometimes, too, the stuff that doesn't give you the answer definitively, but reframes the question. You know,
okay, give me an example.
I knew you were going to say that. Oh, this is so... I hope there's no C.S. Lewis fans in the audience, because this is so mangled. But I just remember once reading... What is it? Oh, God. Grief. What's his book about grief? C.S. Lewis.
Grief is a thing with... No, that was...
I know, that's what I was going to say. It's Tom Porter.
Is that what you're going to say?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Grief Observed. Shout out to row number 4. That in A Grief Observed, he's just at the mercy of these, like, looping questions, which I think is often the way that we find ourselves when we're in big, pulsing pain. But he was a Christian, and he talks about maybe imagining one day where, after he's died, and he's looking back on this mortal coil with different eyes and realizing that the whole time he was asking the thing wrong, and it would be as if he was phrasing, like, is square yellow? Like, that he was just, oh, the questions were nonsensical as he understood them when he was still mortal.
This is really interesting because this is something that Toni Morrison has written about, the vulnerability of the idea that doesn't have the answer, right? We are in a, and we've been here for a while, I don't think it's just currently with the political situation, but we're in a place that really loves certainty. And it's really hard, to push back and be receptive to the idea that there will be no pat answer, which I think is some of what you're coming after in these essays and what you do in your music.
I mean, my idea is about what it means to be a woman. I wouldn't say have changed because that would imply certainty. Mm-hmm. They've just sort of dissolved, and I don't have excellent ideas with which to replace them all the time. I think that when I first started, I was really concerned about the way that I didn't want to be perceived. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to be perceived as a person who was asked only to sing the choruses to rap songs. So I didn't want to sing very much at first. I didn't want to be perceived as someone who was maneuvering her way through the world on the strength of how she looked on stage. I didn't want to be mistaken as a fly girl, which would sometimes happen irrespective of my dance. So I used to wear these huge, stupid raver pants, and I would wear boxers instead of panties, and I would fold the boxers over the raver pants, so you knew that I was wearing boxers. And I would wear these huge, like, you know, triple X sweatshirts because I wanted to communicate that the reason I'm on stage is for my rap alone. It hadn't occurred to me then that I was surrendering as much to the expectations of female performers as if I had adhered to the standard presentation, meaning making sure that I was wearing the exact opposite of a vinyl dress is being just as influenced by the prevalent trend and expectation of a hypersexualized woman on stage. Because it wasn't like I wore those clothes all the time off stage. I used to wear, you know, comfortable jeans and a tight tee.
But isn't that just some of that maturity and confidence? What happened that you felt like you didn't have to do that anymore?
Oh, well, I mean, in some way I feel like there were some stripes that I earned, so I was less worried that people were going to say, the only reason you're on stage is because you're dancing around in a tight T-shirt. You know, I felt like, okay, I put out some music and people know and seem to respond to that music, so I wasn't as worried. But also I think that some of, when I look back on the bios that I wrote myself in my early 20s, they're very sexist. They're bios that I wrote about me, you know, because so
they were very sexist.
Yeah.
Why?
I think there's like a phenomenon that that isn't uncommon in hip hop during that era where there was one woman in an otherwise all male crew, just because there's not that many women in hip hop. But the stance that woman takes is like, oh, I must be such a G to be able to hang with all these guys, which underscores that idea that dudes are better at this naturally, so I must be very good if I can keep company with them, which is essentially like what my bio said. I must be very good if I can keep company with these guys. That's not woke, you know? So I think, and as I like move on, I think to imagine that one is inoculated from the sexism that pervades our culture by the fact that she is a woman is ridiculous.
You're listening to Dessa at Talking Volumes. We talked about her new book, My Own Devices, and a whole lot of other stuff. I asked Dessa about the collective memory that she shares with her fellow Doomtree hip-hop group members around breathing and the shape of words. And Dessa had some interesting things to say.
It's so strange. So I think there are a couple of members of Doomtree in the house tonight. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's Laserbeak. I recognize the voice. So we recently did a show, you know, where all the members of Doomtree are on stage together. But for a long time now, we've been touring as solo artists. So those songs, you know, have a significant amount of dust on them. We haven't performed them together for a long time. And I was trying to describe it. I think it was to my mom. I was just, that feeling of a beat starts, right? And it's a familiar beat. You've heard it a million times. But even this maybe sometimes happen with songs that you just like. You know it, but you don't know which one it is. You don't know how it goes. Mm-hmm. Oh, which song? I know the song. And then you're waiting there and you're looking at the other rappers to see if they seem to know what's supposed to happen. And then sometimes you'll point at one of the rappers to say, do you go first or do I go first? And then all of a sudden, whenever it's your turn, it's like someone reaches... How to do this in a not sexual way. It's as though you are a slack marionette and someone has picked up those crossed boards to animate you. And it's almost like the words just come up and out through you, which is strange because I think for me anyway, like... words are cerebral. I think them and then I say them. So to have some words just come up my shoulders, out my neck, and through my mouth, it's a very weird feeling because it really is, at that point, a muscular memory and not a verbal memory. And it's just such a strange sensation. You're literally going, I don't know who goes, but oh, I guess it's my turn. Yeah.
I have an appreciation for your, what seems to be endless interest in memory and the science of it, but also the emotional part of it.
I think it's you, honestly, that has an endless interest in memory. You, oh, okay, okay, but go ahead.
Okay, guilty, but so do you. You're thinking about how we change memory, how memory changes us. The neuroscience of that is so interesting, but it's still being developed, so we don't understand that well. I mean, that's where I thought you were going to with trying to figure out this love, this persistent, determined love. Like, the memory of this. I think who we were is so powerful, too. Go ahead.
I mean...
how
yeah.
We crave those memories, even as they give us a lot of pain. Go ahead.
I think when I first started getting involved in the neuroscience stuff, I was prompted by a natural curiosity. Like, I really dig science. It excites me, and it has since I was little. And understanding particularly the kind of science that helps account for behavior that we don't understand about ourselves. That's always fascinating. Maybe it's like that, yeah. Whenever you're in fifth grade and you learned about the subconscious, it's
yeah.
Like, whoa. And I just still am like that. Whoa. But it was also driven not by just an intellectual interest, mm-hmm. You know, so I wasn't thinking, gosh, memory, what a fertile subject for exploration. I was thinking, this hurts, and I'd like it to stop hurting. And so when I learned that there was some neuroscience that seemed to undergird our subjective feelings of love, I thought, huh, that's interesting. Like, I'd heard that there was this part of there were several portions of the brain that would reliably activate when you're in romantic love and you contemplate the person for whom you have those feelings. And I was surprised by that there was like this measurable way that the brain would participate in love. And I thought, hey, if I could find the places in my brain that are participating in this love that is long outstayed its welcome, then maybe I could get it out.
I want to tell you about this novel that I read a couple months ago. The author is Jason Mott, and he created, it's a dystopian kind of setting, and he created two twins. One of them remembers everything. In fact, one of them carries the memory of what's vanishing because of this dystopia. The other one forgets everything. And that is the twin who people regard as having the gift, the ability to forget, which is kind of what you were exploring in this. No, you're not trying to wipe the memory.
Yeah, okay.
But you're kind of trying to alter it and forget some of it. What are you thinking?
I think I was trying to remove I didn't want to forget anything, because if someone, you know, presented me with a contract where I could forfeit the memory and the insight associated with it to be happy, I don't think I would be too interested in it. Because it feels like I would understand the world less.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a hard pill for me to swallow. But at the same time, I didn't want to be so steamrolled by these feelings that my life sucked. There's a certain amount of time that I think all of us endure big sadnesses. That's part of being alive. But I didn't want to say, like, okay, this is a really big stretch of your life. Like, is this going to be most of your life? Because then it doesn't feel like a learning episode. Then it just feels like, oh, I had a sad life. That sounded really bad. So I wanted to know if there was a way to, you know, not to zap Men in Black style the memory away, but if there was a way to feel like I could retain or regain like some of my agency, because I felt like I really was at the mercy of these feelings. I didn't feel like I was in control all the time.
What if science could go in and remove the yearning?
I think it depends how for me. If it's, 'cause it's one thing, it's like, right now science can remove the 5 pounds with an elliptical machine. Like that's, you know what I mean? That's science.
No.
So when we say, hey.
No.
If I say, oh, by 2019, I'd like to feel healthier and be leaner and be more cardiovascularly fit, I might look up a workout program. Well, science did that. Somebody studied a lot of people who were hoping to lose 5 pounds or whatever for a few months and says, hey, we think it's calories in and calories out. We would suggest that you lift some light weights. We would suggest that you take 10,000 steps. Science is not this otherworldly thing. Science is happening right now. I'm talking into a microphone. This is science. Science is just a kind of curiosity that asks that we look to and trust empirical evidence.
That's what science is. That's the biggest dodge.
It's,
oh my gosh. Yeah. Dodging it.
If I could undergo a surgery to make me feel better.
No.
No. But the reason.
No. Hold on. What if you possessed the memory and that came with the pain, the love, the experience of it, but there was a way to go in and erase the yearn?
But that's called Zoloft. Or no, it's called like Prozac. I mean, but when you're trying to change your mood, I mean, we have drugs for that.
But I mean, Zoloft doesn't go back and erase the experience of what it is to yearn.
No, I wouldn't want to erase experiences I've had.
Why?
Because I think I would feel like I was trading gaining a feeling of well-being at the expense of an authentically lived life. Do you think that's a dodge?
No, I think the yearning is what made you in some ways. Would never want to mess with that. Some people yearn in life and other people don't.
A yearner.
Don't you think?
Yeah, like how would you compare a yearner to a seeker? Are they similar? Is it the yearning is what drives the seeking?
No. I think this is never getting on the radio. This is like, what the hell were they smoking? That's it.
Yes, I would say that dispositionally, I want things badly. Yeah.
Yeah, I meant specifically this relationship and this love.
This love and what I've been lucky enough to be in other loves too. Like, I want that.
No, this love.
Okay, yes.
The fact that it hasn't been fully unrequited, but in some ways it's been...
Unattainable.
Unattainable.
Absolutely.
Which is kind of the other side of yearning, or is mixed with yearning, right? But... The yearning has been so essential to your art.
That word
it?
Is starting to sound weird. Yes.
This sounded so good in my head when I
stared
it out.
The short answer is yes. Like, I mean, yeah, absolutely. That dissatisfaction, that yearning, that want, feeling sad, prompted me to write some songs I'm really proud of. And I think they're, and I stand behind. I think
like,
they're very good.
Like what?
Like the song Call Off Your Ghost.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wrote that, like, there's so little creativity in the actual circumstance of that song, because I was like, here I am, in a new dress at an old friend's wedding. I mean, it was just literally that. The lyrics of the verses in that song are literally true, and that I was standing in that circumstance and went out to my car to write the lyrics on a parking ticket.
Wow.
And back in, yeah. But at some point, you know, you don't want to only write those songs. You don't want to feel like, as an artist even, let alone a person, that you're retreading really familiar emotional ground,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of chipping away at a spent mine, yeah.
You and I talked about this one time, just getting together, and I asked you about who you think you could have been if you'd never had this kind of experience or felt the unattainability of this. Mm-hmm. I think you dodged it that night, too.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
It has been a formative experience for me. I mean, there's no two ways about it. I think also, okay, so an example of how that unanswered romance like changed the rest of me. I remember really, really being brought to my knees by one episode. And by that, I mean literally on my knees on the carpet. And I was very sad. And I was also so embarrassed about how sad I was. I thought, what a spoiled thing to wish away this day when so many people would give anything for another day. And here you are waiting for this part of your life to be over. How dare you? And then I thought about when I ran away from home, how hurt my mom was. And I was like, but she just kept telling me that. And I know, and I wanted to say, like, I'm listening, I know, and I'm sorry, but I can't, I don't have anything to say, that we have to move on. And then in that moment on my knees, I thought, oh, this is hurt. This is what that was. And maybe even what I was experiencing was only a fraction because we have a different relationship. But I just hadn't understood the kind of magnitude we could be talking about. And when I thought, oh, my 14-year-old self, who said, oh, I get it, Mom, you're sad. She didn't really understand what was behind that grown woman's sternum.
Do you ever think that, I mean, you've written the other story, right, in your head? And the other story goes...
How does it go?
Well, doesn't it go... I mean, isn't the obvious other story
he loves
isn't
me.
Elusive, he isn't unattainable. Is he... He's not here tonight, is
nope.
he? Just by some chance. That's the other story, right? And
yeah.
What that would have meant to who you are.
And to be honest, I've wondered. I mean, maybe the reason that I wanted it so consistently for so long is because I couldn't have it.
Right.
Yeah, it could be that, you know?
What if it is that?
Yeah, that's now. I mean, that's what if it is that is how I'm living the rest of my life. It could be that when I next fall in love, because I fell in love with another guy in a meaningful way, not in a sidebar way. You know, for years we were in love. I don't know. Maybe that's like get a great New York shrink and talk about commitment issues. But it is... Yeah, I don't know that that's not true. The intermittent reward is the thing that will keep the mouse at the lever for cocaine. If the mouse gets cocaine every time the mouse presses the lever, the mouse is less interested in that lever than if it only happens sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's reward science. And that may well be that I am she mouse.
What do you think that means for... I mean... You've put this out here, you're talking a lot about this, you've told yourself, I don't know if I buy this, you've told yourself that these treatments you were having, or the, what is it, biofeedback, or...
Neurofeedback.
Yeah, neurofeedback worked.
I don't know if I did tell myself that they worked.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I was careful, because first of all, I want to make sure not to be a bad... communicator and liaison and ambassador for science. Science is not done by one person going and having experience in that settled science. So first I wanted to make sure to honor the researchers with whom I work to say this is an anecdotal experience first. Second, even though I did feel better after doing some of this neurofeedback stuff on my brain, well, that could be for a bunch of reasons.
Yeah.
That could be because I'm talking to scientists about my love life all day long. It's like talk therapy with scientists. It could be the placebo effect. You know, absolutely. So I wouldn't say like, oh, this is settled. But I would say that I didn't feel Sound of Music, Spin on a Hill, Joyful, but I felt less obsessive.
What if it's just you're not holding the secret anymore?
It could be that.
It could be that too. What this feels like.
A lot of, yeah, I will say that I know a lot of us, all of us, go through big heartbreaks. Part of my job, essentially, to do my job well, I had to lie about that for years. Because a stage show is ruined by throwing a fit or a tantrum or falling into tears.
You mean by being openly sad?
If you're in the middle of a rap song. Yeah. Yeah.
So a lot of that performance...
It's like saying... you just have to check that. You cannot feel that way right now. You can feel it later. You can feel it in the woman's bathroom during soundcheck. Mm-hmm. But you cannot feel that now. Now is the time for other feelings. And you have to, by force of will or whiskey, find a way to those other feelings. You have to. Because it's not just for me. It's for everybody. It's our whole damn crew. And one of the things that I'm proudest of in my life is that we didn't ruin it.
Yeah.
You know, like... Yeah, I think, like, for both of us, you know, that was hard. Probably harder for me, but just because I think, more emotional on it. But it's like, you know, if you met someone and you fell in love and then you had a really rocky breakup, but you raised a rad kid. And you can high-five each other and be like, you know, there was something special we were a part of. And we didn't let the worst of ourselves or the most delicate spoil it. It got to be beautiful. And I'm outrageously proud of that.
That's what you mean by... ruin it, that it could have...
Well, if I just threw up my hands and said, forget it, I'm out, or if he said, I don't want her in this crew, or if I said, I don't want to work with him, like... But we went the other way. It was like, I was graceless sometimes, for sure, and he was too, but I wanted to be graceful. I did, and he did too. And even when it was very, very, very difficult, we wanted to stay in the crew because the crew is important and it's more important, maybe, than...
What more important than...
I don't even know how to describe it. Like, this is the most hip-hop part of my... I know that, like, in a lot of ways, like, I'm a nerd and I tease that out for comic value, but the way that loyalty works in hip-hop, I think, is one of the most beautiful parts of that culture. It's just... It's hard to overstate. I mean, without a glint of humor, people say, like, I will bury a body for you. I mean it. Like, you need me any hour, any time, for any reason, and I will be there, period. There's no blood between these people. Mm-hmm. And that's a lifetime bond. Who the hell do you get that with? Like, those are my family. That's the end of it. And I'm theirs. And as soon as they asked me into the crew, it was like, it doesn't feel like a job offer. It feels like, these are my brothers until we're dead. Those are my brothers. You know?
And you didn't wreck the loyalty of them.
And we didn't ruin it. We didn't explode the good thing.
One last excerpt?
Yeah.
This is from near the end of the book.
In this moment, I'm explaining to my ex that I'm embarking on a pretty serious and pretty weird scientific endeavor to try to fall out of love with him. But... he's wondered if maybe we should try again romantically.
Dun, 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 dun. Huh.
I thought he should know about the project before we met. I sent him a text explaining all of it. The neurofeedback, the fMRI lab, the brain waves, the team of scientists recruited to help excise my love for him. I told him that as an art project, I was excited and proud of what I was doing. But it could also, like, work. So if we were really going to take another shot at it, I might have to change course. I watched the little chasing dots that meant that he was writing. Very cool. Very, very you. Charming and heartbreaking. In the days before our dinner date... I turned myself inside out, trying to consider the situation from every possible vantage point. Was there some middle ground? Could I use neurofeedback just to remove the painful part of the love,
the resentment, the jealousies, and leave the rest intact. But a tiger defanged isn't really a tiger anymore. If my love for X was rendered tame and gentle, I wasn't even sure I'd recognize it. The Brain Project had reinvigorated me. I hadn't been as excited about anything in years. My life's interests, philosophy, science, art, the mechanics of human connection, they'd all seemed to coalesce in this one endeavor, and I'd started to really look like the woman I'd hoped to become, an artist living in New York, who maneuvered on subway platforms with enough confidence to be approached by lost tourists for help. A few times, while studying the limbic system or reading about the history of lobotomy, my enthusiasm had welled up with such force that it was barely discernible from nausea. And now it seemed I had to choose. I might not get another shot at either the Brain Project or at a reconciliation with X. And I couldn't do both. As a girl, I remember watching one sequence in The Little Mermaid with special distress. It's when Ariel becomes human, when her tail splits into legs and she can't breathe underwater anymore and they take her voice away. I hated that moment when her tail tore in two because she'd given too much. X arrived 20 minutes late to dinner. I'd picked a restaurant where I didn't think we were likely to be recognized by people who listened to our music. It was mostly empty. He ordered appetizers. We talked about small things, shared status reports on our families, our careers. Every couple has a cache of signature maneuvers in times of conflict. Some go in for theatrics, streaked mascara and hang up phone calls. Some costume their feelings as rational propositions and negotiate like lawyers at a breakfast table. Some compete to be the first to leave the house in an understated exit that demonstrates their restraint and long-suffering grace. The dance that X and I do looks like one of those courtship routines of tropical birds. Every time one of us steps forward, the other steps back. We're each eager to see the other fully commit before doing so ourselves. We've played and lost this game before. Neither of us has an appetite for uncollateralized risks.
I got snow in my pockets when done again head first. Lace drill bits to my point shoes, pirouette through the hardwood to pay dirt. Night falls, day breaks, time has a funny kind of violence, and I'm trying to keep in mind it can't leave you the way it finds you. Good grief, I've heard people say what a phrase, what a state to be in, but I don't know where they go to get that feeling. My knees, they clean, not much for praying. I do my own stunts and my own saving, but there's something I miss, something I've been missing.
They say there's good grief.
Fuselage and engine and both wings, but I'm ready to work for this. Just show me what it did. I'm ready to hurt for this. I know exactly what this is.
Dessa's new book is called My Own Devices. I'll see you talking volumes tonight at 7 o'clock.
How can you tell it from a bed? Maybe it's only in effect. Good grief's the one. should be upset, but I'm in my neck, I'm on the line, thinking better that they're gonna be afraid of this so long.
News coverage of business and the economy is supported by Allianz Life, offering financial solutions to help Americans prepare for their future with more confidence. Allianz, promises kept. Online at allianzlife.com.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.